It was a very cruel scene, executed in an unusual manner.
Hey, Cruel Coven.
Hey, Goody Goody Gumdrops.
Ooh, I like that.
Put me in a tongue lock.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm Tori.
I'm Katie.
And welcome to Cruel and Unusual,
the podcast.
We're here, you guys.
We're here. We have not abandoned post.
Not this time.
No.
Tori. I mean, we kind of abandoned it, but not intentionally.
No. Would you like to give them, just before, I know we said we're not going to talk a lot at the beginning of these episodes, but just really quick.
And if you don't want to hear it, fucking skip ahead.
Do you care to explain yourself?
I will explain myself. Okay. So, first, we were exposed to COVID.
Mm-hmm.
My daughter and I were with my niece and her cousin, obviously, like all day long on Sunday, the past Sunday, not a couple Sundays ago, okay? And so then Katie and I, we had to quarantine, so Katie and I could not record. And then the next week, I was blessed with swollen optic nerves.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds a little silly, but that's what happened. And I was told that I would potentially need a shunt.
Brain surgery.
Or I would lose my vision. And all of that happened all last week. I think we're in the clear.
Yeah.
I have one more appointment. But then my MRI was good.
Yeah, you had to get the MRI.
Yeah.
And see a neurologist. Mm-hmm. And then I think I posted about, in the group, I had a sinus infection. I'm like, fuck.
Yeah, so Katie COVID. Thought she had COVID.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't, thankfully, but it still sucked. And then I also had my period.
Yeah. So she was hit with a freaking double whammy.
Awful.
I was going to need brain surgery. We almost got COVID. Mm-hmm. It's been a rough couple of weeks.
And then that was the same time we got like a foot of snow.
Yes. And we were stuck in our homes for 4 days.
Yes.
We've been going through some shit and we're here. We've got part two. We worked very hard on this mm-hmm. entire thing. And now we're going to give it to you straight.
This is part two of Colleen Stan's survival story. Do you want to start us off, Tori, and kind of refresh a little bit?
Yeah, I'll bring us up to speed and then I'll give you some new info. Okay, so we are starting at the point here where Colleen Stan had been in Cameron and Janice Hooker's basement for about a month at this point. As you know from our last episode, she's been enduring horrible assaults, whippings, confinements, and torture at the hands of Cameron Hooker. No one has heard from Colleen, and with no leads to go on as to where she might be, her parents, who had been divorced for 18 years at this time, drove up to Eugene, Oregon, where Colleen had been living with her roommates, to kind of like look around and maybe potentially get some of her things if they could. This was around Saturday, June 25th, 1977. While they were up there, they did contact the Eugene Police Department, hoping for an update, but unfortunately, the police could not tell them anything new at all. And so they packed up Colleen's belongings and headed home on Interstate 5, having no clue that as they passed Red Bluff, they were within a mile of where their young daughter was being held prisoner in that basement. Meanwhile, this entire time, Colleen had not been able to bathe. She could not wash her hair, she could not brush her teeth. And due to, most likely, the immense trauma and malnutrition, she had stopped menstruating. She was able to kind of gauge what time of day it was by listening for cars outside and relying on how warm or cool it felt inside of the box. Cameron took it upon himself to try to keep air circulating inside of the box by installing what he called a quote-unquote blower. All this was a hairdryer on a no-heat setting, blowing air through two drilled holes on the side of the box. And obviously, it did very little to bring Colleen relief. And this was also around the time when Cameron noticed Colleen's weight was plummeting, and he began tracking her weight by forcing her to stand on a scale. He was continuing to tie Colleen to the rack, keep her in the box, or suspend her from the ceiling by her arms. He would always whip her. That was a constant. And now Colleen began hearing a camera shutter clicking. He was taking photographs of her that he developed himself in his own makeshift darkroom. Janice Hooker remained out of sight for the most part. Once in a great while, she would come down to the basement and give Colleen a drink, and sometimes Colleen would hear Janice talking upstairs, but that was pretty much the extent of it. At this point, Janice was just completely sick over the whole ordeal. She was terrified that they would get caught, and guilt began to settle in, and soon, that guilt would start to eat her alive. Also, Janice was very conflicted because she was starting to feel jealous of Colleen. I mean, her husband is spending all of his time with Colleen in the basement. He's disgustingly fixated on her, and there just was not enough to go around for Janice. So Janice decided to move out for a little bit, just to get away from the house and everything going on inside of it. She went to stay with her older sister, she got a job, and she went back home to Cameron in Red Bluff on the weekends. And despite the immense guilt and all of those negative feelings she had about what Cameron was doing to Colleen, she didn't say a word about any of it to her sister. And she could have, but she didn't. It seems to me that not being at the house with Cameron at all for 5 days a week almost helped Janice to kind of like block it all out, kind of, and pretend it wasn't happening. And Janice ended up living this way for several months before she finally came back home to Cameron.
Around this time is when Colleen would finally learn the names of the people who'd been keeping her prisoner in their basement, because remember, she was always blindfolded. She didn't know anything about these people, not even what they looked like. She'd heard Cameron call his wife Jan, so that one was easy. And she thought she heard Janice call her husband Cameron, but Colleen wasn't sure. One day, she was able to peek out just a tiny little sliver from her blindfold, and she noticed the name Cameron was engraved on the back of his belt. Now, this is a seemingly tiny thing. You know, like in the grand scheme of it all, knowing their names doesn't help her in the moment, but remember how sensory deprived she's been this entire time? It was something new. She finally learned something about these people, and I can only imagine that that felt like a little nugget of something.
Yeah, I feel like any little glimpse of anything that she could potentially hold on to was huge for her.
Exactly. Around 6 months in, Cameron started having Colleen do jobs for him, like sanding wood, blindfolded. One day, he led her into this little soundproof room he'd built under the basement stairs that he called the workshop. He had her unshackled, but still blindfolded. Once she was inside, he closed the door and told her to take the blindfold off. This was the first time in 6 months that she was able to take that blindfold off. She noticed a big bag of walnuts on the floor, and Cameron told her to shell them. But just imagine how it must have felt to finally be able to see, to not be shackled for once, to be able to just like sit down. She could move around somewhat freely. Now, she did try the door, of course. She tried to get out, but it wouldn't budge. So she got to work on the walnuts. She spent the night in the workshop, and Cameron took her out in the morning after telling her to put the blindfold back on because she still wasn't allowed to see his face. And then he put her back in the box. This became a new routine. She'd spend the day inside of the box while Cameron was at work. When he got home, he'd bring her food and then sexually assault her, whip her. There were incidents of strangulation, electrocution, burning. The list goes on. And then at night, she'd be locked in the workshop, usually with a task to do. They would have her do things like crochet, they'd have her do macrame, just whatever they felt like having her do. These projects that they made Colleen do, like the crochet and little crafts and stuff, they sold them for money at a flea market. And the people buying them clearly had no idea that they were made by a girl being held captive and tortured in the hooker's basement. I don't know. I just cannot. Like, imagine owning one of those.
Right. Which is very ironic because a lot of the things that we own in America are made by, you know, 10-year-old children in sweatshops.
There are sweatshops here, too.
Yeah,
right. Made in the USA. Right. That Made in the USA label. This has nothing to do with Colleen. But that label means nothing.
No.
It does not mean that it was made ethically.
Right, exactly.
Sorry for the little tangent there, but I just think that's so sick. On the evening of January 25th, 1978, so 9-ish months since her abduction, Colleen saw Cameron's face for the first time. She was in the workshop when he barged in holding a clipboard. He handed it to her, and on it was a piece of paper and a pen. He wanted her to practice her signature. Colleen had no idea what was going on, but she did what he said. Then Cameron handed her an article from a newspaper and told her to read it. What I'm about to read is an excerpt from the book The Perfect Victim by Christine McGuire and Carla Norton. Quote, Colleen had read nothing in 251 days. Now she was confronted with a story about the buying and selling of women. She tried to focus on the words, trying to understand. With mounting horror, she read that the quote-unquote S&M rage had created a demand beyond common prostitution and had given rise to a new, more depraved trade. Even in the United States, it said, women were forced to sign contracts, totally relinquishing control over their lives, their bodies, their souls. Sold into slavery, these women have no rights and no recourse. Their owners can do with them whatever they wish. An underground brotherhood of slave traders, as large and well-oiled as the mafia, not only controls this traffic in young flesh, but also enforces order, hunting down and punishing runaways. End quote.
So, yeah, that's what Colleen was reading, and it kind of made sense to her, as in, oh, that's why I'm here. Like, she couldn't believe that it was actually a thing, but the article had a photo of a bound woman, and it looked all too familiar to her. And she was incredibly shaken up by this, and rightfully so. That's when Cameron told her that, quote-unquote, they knew that she was there. Not the police, the company. This network of quote-unquote slave traders that the article was written about. He told her that they knew about her and now he had to register her. So, just in case you aren't aware, this is complete bullshit. There's no such thing as a company, at least not in Cameron's world.
Right, and even if Cameron did believe that this company was real or that there were things like it, he was not a part of it.
Right. The article that she had looked at was from one of those underground newspapers that Cameron just loved, and he wasn't a part of some grand company. He did not know shit about shit. He was just using this article and the fake contract that he made Janice type up to deepen the control that he had over Colleen and make her feel like this entire thing went much deeper than it actually did. Colleen ended up signing it, but not without a fight, because she did really believe that it was all true. Once she signed it, he put an identification collar on her, and he gave Colleen the quote-unquote slave name, K. That's it, just the letter K. And he told her that since everything was official, he'd be able to let her out to do things, because the company would back him up. The company would provide security, like surveilling the house and monitoring the phone line. He told her that if she ever tried to run away, the company would hunt her down and make her pay. He told her that Janice had also been a quote-unquote slave once, and she tried running away, and the company twisted and obliterated her legs. This made sense to Colleen because she had noticed Janice wearing a leg brace. The brace was from a knee surgery in all reality, but Colleen did not know that, and it just made the story even more real to her. She'd been so deprived of information of everything but pain and torture and isolation that this made sense. This whole slave trade company gave her a way to comprehend just how she had been pulled into this nightmare. Now, since she signed the bogus contract and became Cameron's slave, she was able to come up out of the basement. But there were still strict rules that she had to follow, of course. She had to address Cameron as sir or master and Janice as ma'am. She was not allowed to look Cameron in the face. She was not allowed to cross her legs. She was not allowed to wear underwear. She had to kneel before Cameron and ask permission before doing anything. And if she tried to contact her family, the company would kill them, being her family, and Colleen would be severely punished. Colleen was brought upstairs at nighttime to do household chores. It was still awful, but it was better than the box. She was even allowed to use the bathroom, after kneeling and asking permission, of course. Cameron kept up his terrifying stories about the company and what they did to women who ran away, what they were capable of, etc. And it got to the point where Colleen was just as much afraid of them as she was of Cameron. It went on like this for a while until one night when Colleen was left inside of the workshop, down in the basement, for an extended period of time. Something wasn't right. It had been about 48 hours when suddenly Cameron opened the workshop door in the middle of the night, pulled Colleen out, handcuffed and blindfolded her, and then led her out of the house. This was the first time in almost an entire year that she'd been outside.
Janice and the baby were in the truck waiting, and Cameron pushed Colleen into the cab and made her lay sideways with her head on Janice's lap. Colleen had no idea what was going on, where they were going, or what would happen once they got there. The drive wasn't long, about 5 miles, and once Cameron parked the truck, Colleen was led up a few steps into a house and then into a room in that house. Once Cameron had her in the room, he took her blindfold off and uncuffed her, and Colleen saw that she was in a bedroom. It had a waterbed, which sat high up on this kind of pedestal, like a wooden pedestal, that had a hole at the base. The hole led to the empty space under the waterbed. Cameron told her that this is where she was going to be staying now. So what this place was the hooker's new property. This mobile home sat on about an acre of land just outside of the Red Bluff city limits. They didn't have super close neighbors anymore, and it was remote but not entirely secluded. It allowed them plenty of privacy. The box under the waterbed was much like the box Cameron had built at their previous house. Colleen was forced to spend most of her time inside of it, and she was let out for a little while each day to do chores and eat. She was able to go outside now since they were more isolated, but when she was out there, she was doing strenuous yard work. The sexual assaults continued, and all of the same horrific stuff Cameron was doing before continued. He built a shed, this kind of outbuilding, where he liked to take Colleen to torture and abuse her. He soldered a permanent stainless steel collar on her. So in the meantime, Janice had become pregnant again, and Cameron talked her into giving birth at home. No doctor, no midwife, none of that. So Janice had their second daughter on the waterbed. She birthed her on the waterbed while Colleen laid in the box directly underneath. So now, with another mouth to feed, money was getting tight. So Janice ended up needing to find a job. She was hired at this little ice cream stand, and she'd go to work after Cameron got home from work, which was about 4 p.m. So this left Cameron with a lot of time on his hands to do what he wanted with Colleen. It usually started with him having Colleen cook dinner and take care of the baby and the toddler, because he sure as shit was not about to feed a baby or change a diaper. He was getting more and more inventive with his torture devices. He started making Colleen do rigorous exercise, like running down a dirt road while he chased after her in the car. And sometimes he forced her to drink alcohol. There were a lot of abuse situations described in The Perfect Victim, the book, but we're not going to go like into super deep detail because it's just more of the same horrible shit. Now, Janice was somehow still under the impression that Cameron was not raping Colleen or doing anything sexual to her at all. Janice believed that he was only hanging her and whipping her. One night, though, Cameron made Colleen drink a bunch of wine, and then he forced her to perform oral sex on Janice. This is when things slowly started taking a turn. Days turned into months and months into years, and the routine hardly varied. But eventually, Cameron had started to let Colleen out of the box for longer periods of time. She was given more responsibility. She had less supervision. She took care of the vegetable garden. She was the sole babysitter for the two little girls. And it's said that she took these responsibilities very seriously. And she devoted herself to these children. Colleen was even allowed, now, to go to town. She could shop. She could meet new people. She could talk to them. She went out dancing at a bar with Janice. All of these normal, day-to-day things that she once felt she'd never be able to do again. But She also had come to accept the fact that she was a slave, and she did. She accepted that this was her life now, and she tried her darndest to be everything that Cameron wanted her to be. And this, I'm not a doctor, clearly, but this is some very deep psychological shit. This isn't Colleen giving up by any means. She's just simply trying to survive because she wholeheartedly believed in the company and all of these lies that Cameron was spewing. He was now instilling in her that all of the things that he did to her, that Cameron did to her, he had to do them because they were the policy of the company.
At one point, Janice lost her job, and Cameron forced Colleen to panhandle in Reno outside of a convention center. This did not make them much money, but it further solidified the fact that Colleen would, quote-unquote, behave while in public, that she would not try to run or tell anyone what was going on, and that was because she was afraid of the company. More neighbors began to move into the area where the hookers lived, and of course they'd seen Colleen outside or with the girls, and they would get curious. Cameron would say that she was their live-in babysitter or housekeeper, or that she was just a friend who needed somewhere to stay. Janice eventually got another job. This one had daytime hours. And so for the first time, Colleen was out of the box all day long because she had to babysit. It was around this time that Colleen started asking Cameron if she could contact her family, and he actually allowed her to write 3 letters to her sister. He did, however, closely monitor what she wrote. It was along the lines of, she was living with a family, nannying, and learning how to can fruit. The letters were sent with no return address, of course, and Cameron mailed them from a different town. But Colleen actually wanted to speak with her family, not just write letters that couldn't be answered. So she kept asking Cameron, and he finally let her call home from a payphone in Chico. Colleen called her dad, and her little sister Bonnie answered. They both became extremely emotional at the sound of each other's voices, and Colleen ended up telling Bonnie that she was okay and that she really missed everyone back home. Colleen also learned that she had a new stepsister. She knew that her stepmom was pregnant before she was abducted, but now her stepmom had given birth and the baby was 3 years old. Colleen told Bonnie that she was quote-unquote up north when Bonnie asked where she was, and it was all very vague. All of this newfound freedom and actually being able to speak with her sister made Colleen extremely thankful. And despite the fact that Cameron was still very much brutalizing her and raping her, she began expressing love for him. She even told him that she loved him. And this made Cameron believe that he was right all along, that all women wanted was to be dominated. So he began expressing his sick version of love in return, all the while still physically and mentally tormenting Colleen. He shared his secrets with her, his deepest desires, his hopes, and his dreams. He wanted the whole family to live in this cabin in Lake Tahoe, and she told him that she would be his slave wife, and they would have kids together. Janice, on the other hand, rarely spoke to Colleen, unless she was giving her orders. Colleen was afraid of Janice. Janice was jealous, and at the same time, she was also sad for Colleen. The two just did not get along. They began fighting, they both complained to Cameron about each other, and he began whipping and abusing them both to a severe extent, believing that it would make them behave because he wore the pants, goddammit. He started giving Colleen what he called obedience tests, one of which was putting a shotgun into her mouth and making her pull the trigger, not knowing if it was loaded or not. When she passed his test and proved obedient, he planned a trip for them. He was going to take her down to Riverside to visit her family. He'd filled her head with lies about the company, how they were watching, how they'd tapped her family's phone lines, and one wrong step, they would all pay. He told her what to tell her family. He was her fiancé, Mike, who had to go to San Diego for work. She was supposed to tell them that he dropped her off on his way, and she was to say that they were in the middle of moving, so she couldn't give them any address or phone number to reach her at, but she would as soon as they were settled. She talked Cameron into letting her stop by her grandma's house, where they visited, and Cameron stayed in the car. And then he took Colleen to her father's house and drove off before anyone there saw him. She had a whirlwind 24 hours to visit her family, even though she was promised an entire weekend, and they all noted how scraggly, unhealthy, and unkempt she was. But Colleen remained evasive when pressured to give details about where she'd been all these years. Cameron came to pick her up, briefly met her family, and then they were off.
When they got back to Red Bluff, something had changed in Cameron. I don't know if he was scared of this whole thing and how far deep he was in it, but he put Colleen into the box and rarely ever let her out for the next 3 years. It wasn't until 1984, when Colleen was 27, that she was gradually allowed more freedom again. This was her 7th year of captivity. She and Jan had actually become a little closer due to frequent prayer that they did together, and Colleen was let out of the box more and more. She gained some weight, because she was severely underweight before, and she was starting to look more healthy, and Cameron now decided that Colleen was ready to live her life fully outside of the box. Colleen went on a job hunt and found one as a maid at a motel called King's Lodge. Her routine consisted of gardening in the morning and then getting ready for work. Sometimes Janice drove her to work, sometimes she rode her bike. She would do her job, and then she would come home and do other chores around the house. Colleen and Janice even regularly went to church services, and going to church proved to be not so great for Cameron in the end. Janice began to really question what was going on inside of her home. She was very conflicted. She felt powerless, and she was confused. Up until now, she was kind of like the queen of compartmentalizing, but anxiety was starting to eat at her, and she just couldn't take it any longer. Her and Colleen were now very close friends, and they had fostered a genuine connection. But as close as they were, Janice was still lying to Colleen about the company. She was still going along with the charade because she, herself, was victimized and manipulated by Cameron. And she knew that she was complicit in holding Colleen captive. So Janice began seeking advice from her pastor, Pastor Dabney. And at first she was just kind of asking him about what the roles of husbands and wives were supposed to be. His advice only made her more confused, because what he was telling her was the complete opposite of what Cameron was telling her. And she realized that Cameron was using the Bible against her. Cameron, in the meantime, kept talking about obtaining more slaves. Janice had simply had enough. This couldn't go on. Her daughters were getting older, it was getting harder to protect them from seeing things that they shouldn't, and she was sick of lying all the time. But she really didn't know what to do. She was complicit, like I said, and she understood this. She didn't want her girls to be taken from her. That was her biggest fear out of everything, was losing her children. And even if she could get out, she had nowhere to go, and she had no way to support herself, especially with 2 young daughters. So Janice turned to Colleen. She was the only other person in the world who understood this predicament. Janice told Colleen that she wanted to leave, that she was going to leave, and she wanted Colleen to come with her and the girls. But Colleen was terrified of this thought because she knew, in her mind, that the company would find them and torture them. There was even one point when Janice asked Cameron to kill her. She couldn't take it anymore, and he almost did kill her. He wrapped his hands around her throat and strangled her to the point where she was almost unconscious. But then he let go. He couldn't go through with it.
Janice spoke to several other pastors, not telling them exact details, but looking for help and advice. Finally, she ended up in front of Pastor Dabney again. What she told him made him believe that her situation was more of a love triangle than sexual slavery, but he told her that they were living in sin and she should do something about it. So, she did. On Thursday, August 9th of 1984, Janice went to the King's Lodge Motel where Colleen was working and asked to speak with her. She found Colleen in one of the motel rooms and told her that they needed to talk. She said, quote, "Cameron lied to you about everything. The company, the slavery contract, all that he told you about me being a slave, all of that was just lies. He lied to scare you, to make you stay his slave," end quote. Colleen totally broke down. It was stunning news. Waves of disbelief and shock and anger rolled over her. 7 years of her life had been stolen from her. She and Janice cried together. Janice asked for forgiveness, and Colleen realized that she was finally free. She could walk away from this life once and for all. They just had to figure out how. So they set up a meeting with Pastor Dabney. The pastor was, of course, shocked by what the woman told him about Colleen being held against her will, the things they had both been subjected to, and what kind of man Cameron really was. Pastor Dabney told them that they should pack their things and leave immediately. He told them that they should go stay with their families. But the thing was, it was almost 4 o'clock in the evening, and Cameron would be off work soon. In fact, Janice was supposed to go pick him up. So Pastor Dabney said to go get Cameron from work as usual, to not be suspicious, and then leave the next day. So that was their plan. Cameron left for work at 5 o'clock the next morning, and as soon as he was gone, Colleen and Janice began to pack. They got the girls ready, and then they fled to Janice's parents' house in Gerber, where they were able to stay the night. But now what? They did talk about staying together, getting a place of their own where they could raise the girls and start a new life together as friends and roommates. Colleen wasn't mad at this idea. She did love the children, and truly, she didn't think Janice could take care of them on her own. They threw around a few other ideas, such as staying with Colleen's dad in Riverside, or just staying there with Janice's parents, but deep down, Colleen had this nagging feeling that she had to go. A voice was telling her that she couldn't and shouldn't help Janice any longer, and that she had to get away and get back home to her family on her own once and for all. Colleen called her dad and asked him to wire $100 for the bus fare home, and he was willing to do whatever it took to get her back.
So the next morning, she's getting ready to leave. She has the bus fare from her father, and the last thing she wants to do before escaping her life is call Cameron. She tells him, quote, "I just wanted to tell you that I'm leaving. I know you lied about everything and you can't keep me here anymore," end quote. It's reported that Cameron cried on the phone with her. When Colleen got home, she told her family everything, or at least some major things that had went on over the past 7 years, and her family urged her to go to the police. Janice had apparently said, quote, "They both owed him the chance," end quote, "to be changed and that Janice could fix him."
There's no fixing someone like that.
No.
And also, there's no fixing someone who does not want to be fixed.
Exactly. Colleen just wanted to put things in the past, so she didn't want to go to the police. It was later found out that Janice spent 1 week away from Cameron at her parents' house before going back to the house she shared with him. She thought that if she started taking him to church, it would change him. Janice started getting really upset because despite going to church, Cameron wasn't changing. Janice ended up confiding in a new friend everything that had happened with Colleen and how she wanted to help Cameron change, but he was stuck the way he was. Her new friend told her that she needed to go to the police, and of course, Janice was very apprehensive again. It's said that the friend brought up Janice's children, who were two little girls, and questioned what was keeping him from abusing and defiling them. And that seemed to kind of light a new fire under Janice, and she went to the authorities and told them everything. She told them that he kidnapped Colleen, he abused her, he kept her in a box. Oh, and by the way, he murdered a woman before all of that. Marie Elizabeth Spinak accepted a ride from Cameron and Janice on January 31st, 1976, when she was 19 years old. Marie had moved from Cleveland to California about a year earlier to live with her fiancé, and apparently her fiancé John and her had gotten into an argument while shopping, so she was walking home. When Marie Elizabeth still wasn't home by February 2nd, he filed a police report. He was a person of interest for a while, but he passed polygraphs. Cameron abducted her pretty much the same way that he abducted Colleen. He picked her up, took her to a remote area, held her at knife point, used the same box on her, and he and Janice ate fast food while waiting for the sun to set before going back home. When they got home, he brought Marie Elizabeth down to the basement, and he hung her up, sexually assaulted her, and then he tried to sever her vocal cords. And he must have severed them enough to the point where she couldn't speak because she had to communicate with him via paper. Ultimately, he ended up shooting her with a pellet gun in the stomach 2 times, according to Janice. He then strangled her and murdered her. He made Janice help roll her body up in a tarp, and then they drove out to a park in Reading, dug a grave for her, and placed her lifeless body in it. Janice said he also took her gold watch off of her and would wear it daily until it got caught in machinery. So Janice confessed to all of this. She supposedly tried to help authorities find the body, but they never could recover it.
On November 18th of 1984, Cameron was arrested and charged with kidnapping, sodomy, and rape. Obviously, multiple accounts. He was not charged with murder, the murder of Marie Elizabeth, because they couldn't confirm it. Obviously, there was no body. So the trial starts, and of course, as defense attorneys do in a case like this, they tried to paint Colleen in a very nasty light. Cameron even got up to testify, and he said that when he kidnapped her, so yes, he did admit to kidnapping her. He said that when he kidnapped her, he was only trying to get her off of drugs because he saw drugs on her or in her purse or something. But then once he kidnapped her, the relationship became platonic. The judge, Clarence Knight, said, quote, "Cameron Hooker is the most dangerous psychopath I've ever dealt with, and he is the opposite of what he seems. He will be a danger to women as long as he is alive, and I intend to sentence the maximum possible," end quote. Something that hurt Colleen's case a little bit was the fact that even after she was home and safe, she would write Cameron, and she would also call him. But court-appointed psychiatrists were able to come in and be like, oh no, this does not mean that Colleen is in love with him. It does not mean that the relationship was platonic. It means that she was held captive for 7 years and she was brainwashed, just like anyone else would be. At the end of the trial, Cameron was slapped with 104 years in prison. He reportedly called Colleen 3 days after he was sentenced and told Colleen that she could, quote-unquote, chew his butt out. Colleen told him that she had nothing to say to him. Colleen Stan still has scars both emotionally and physically from those 7 years that she was kidnapped, raped, tortured, sodomized. There's not much that she did not endure when she was living with the Hookers. She's gone on to do interviews and tell her story in her own words and on multiple platforms. Colleen went on to have a daughter after escaping, and on August 10th of every year, she and her family go to the beach to celebrate her freedom. She also wrote a book called The Simple Gifts of Life back in 2009. She said one of her major life lessons is not to hitchhike. She's then gone on to say, quote, "I thoroughly enjoy my freedom, always, always, always. Life today is good. You have to learn how to live in the now and not let that past drag you back," end quote. Heavy.com says, quote, "Cameron Hooker became eligible for parole in October of 2014, according to his inmate record with the California Department of Corrections. However, after appealing for a parole suitability hearing on April 16th of 2015, the parole board denied parole and ruled he not be eligible again for 15 years. Hooker filed a petition to advance his next parole suitability hearing date, and the parole board denied his request on December 7th of 2018. Hooker remains incarcerated at the California Institution for Men. And in case any of you are wondering about Janice, she was given full, complete immunity in exchange for testifying against her husband. And that pretty much wraps things up. That is a survival story, the incredible survival story of Colleen Stan.
I could never be that strong.
No.
You were talking about, really quick, your MRI that you just had.
Yes.
How awful it was. I've never had one, but I can only imagine how awful it is to be in that tube, in that, it's like so confined.
I was thinking about
over
her.
An hour.
Yeah, I was thinking about her the entire time. I was like, in my head. So if any of you have had an MRI before, they're all a little bit different in how they make you go into that tube. But for mine, because it was of my brain, my head also had to be in this little like container type of thing. So I could only like just my eyes were the only thing out. And it was like clasped over my jaw. And I was thinking about Colleen the entire time. And I was just like, if Colleen could handle this for 7 years. I can deal with this for an hour and 20 minutes. Right. Like, this is... The parallel was just very weird, mm-hmm. that we were researching her case while I was doing that. And it just made me... Obviously, when you hear the story, your first thought is, oh, my God, that would be absolutely awful. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like I didn't have empathy for her before. But after just being confined for an hour and 20 minutes, I was like, I just... Mm-hmm. I just don't, she may very well be the strongest woman I've ever read about.
For real.
Because I don't think that I would be able to get through that.
No. And the confinement, on top of being brutalized, her body, and then all of the sensory deprivation, I could never. And Janice, going back to Cameron after everything was said and done, just goes to show how codependent she was. Absolutely. Or how dependent she was on him and what he had done to her. I don't know. But I do feel like she did have responsibility in this whole thing.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, I do think that there was some responsibility there, for sure. It's hard. Because I do think she was a victim as well.
Right.
But yeah, she and Colleen are very different victims.
Right, yeah.
So it's just a weird, fuzzy
thing. it's not black and white.
Yeah.
All right, guys, if you want to have a little bit of a palate cleanser and hear our reading, watching, listening, you can stick around after the outro music for that. But in the meantime, you can send us an email if you want at cruelandunusualthepod@gmail.com. Our Instagram is at cruelandunusualthepod.
I tweet at cruelunusualpod.
And you can join our Facebook group that is cruelandunusual:the group. We love you.
Oh, that's it.
Are you surprised by that?
Yeah.
That we love them?
Oh, yeah. No. Okay. We love you.
Love you.
Bye.
Bye.
Okay, Katie.
Yes.
What are you reading, watching, and listening to? Will you tell me all about it? Even though we just had a long car ride and we were talking about it, let's talk about it again.
You know, that's a good question. Because what am I? Who am I? What year is it? How did I get here?
I don't know what year it is, who I am, what my favorite color is, what I like to eat. Nothing. And nothing is the same anymore.
Do you know, almost daily, I've been thinking about... how it's still January, but it's not.
It's not. It's truly not.
January was a long boy.
I'm still writing 21 on my papers. Yeah. All my papers I have. Mm-hmm. Just writing 21 on them.
Yeah.
You know, like for therapy and stuff. I'm always writing 21.
Yes.
Not suicidal. 21.
So I actually listened to a podcast that I've been wanting to for a long time, Tenfold More Wicked. Mm-hmm. And it's, if you like historic true crime, this is the one for you. You've all probably listened to it by now because I'm late to every party. But
well, I'm not invited to any of them.
You're always invited. But I listened to season one, and that was about Edward Ruloff in like the 1800s and how he murdered four members of the same family. And he was like this like genius, but he was evil. And his brain, actually, after he died, they took his brain and it was like the cornerstone for like what we know about the human brain.
Wow.
Science these days.
Science in these days.
You know what I'm saying.
Young it children. Was
like studying his brain, the medical field learned so much more about the brain and how it works. Do you get it?
God.
I started listening to The Deck.
It's no idea.
The new Ashley Flowers. Oh. Podcast, but it's the concept is really cool. You know, the trading cards that police would put cold cases on, and then they'd give them to prisons to the prisoners.
Yeah, maybe
to try to get them, you know, to talk or whatever.
Yeah.
So episode one is the cold case of Linda Smith, and she's on the Nine of Hearts. And then there's Raquel Ramirez, who is the Seven of Diamonds. So I think it's a cool concept because these are cases that obviously are not solved,
right?
And they need all the exposure they can get.
Yeah. For sure.
I read The Perfect Victim for this research.
Which a lot of our research came from, mm-hmm. The Perfect Victim.
Really?
And there's even more info in that book.
Oh, there's so much.
We could have easily probably had 3 or 4 parts to the series instead of just 2, just based on research from that book alone.
And then I listened to this newish long form investigative podcast called Bonaparte. And it's about the murder of a young mom. I think she was only like 20.
Wow.
Her name was Laura Van Wy. And it's such a weird story. And it's unsolved. And it's she was found on the side of the road. Like, no evidence that she had been hit by a car or anything. And she was wearing, like, two layers of clothes. Some clothes that weren't hers. Like, a coat that wasn't hers. She had, like, a folded-up paper plate with a scoop of rice in it.
That's weird.
And, like, a baby blanket shoved underneath her shirt. Just a lot of weird, weird things.
Yeah, that's weird.
But it was a really well-done podcast, and I think it's worth a listen.
And what was it called again?
It's called Bonaparte.
Got it.
It's the name of the town that she had, like, gone missing from.
What state is
that
in?
That's in Iowa. I think she was in... I think it's, like, right by the Iowa-Missouri border. But that's it. I haven't been watching anything. Just working and twerking.
Ooh, working and twerking.
Hey, Tori.
Yeah.
What you reading, what you watching, what you listening to?
Ooh! Is that the new reading, watching, listening theme song?
I came up with that jingle in the car.
Did you?
Yeah. It was the first thing. I'm like, oh, that's perfect.
That is perfect.
And I had to remember it.
Spot on.
Mm-hmm.
I'm surprised you did.
I know. I don't remember shit.
Gosh. Okay. Reading, well, The Perfect Victim, obviously. I'm reading a lot of books because I'm editing, so.
There's a train, if you hear it. It's, yeah. That's a train.
Chew, fucking chew. lots of books, new books every week because I edit. I'm listening to No Exit because you have made me do this.
It's a good book.
So you basically have forced me to listen or read No Exit. So
well, yeah. And I wanted you to read it before the Netflix movie came out.
Yeah. I was going to ask you if it was going to be a movie or a series.
I really don't know. I just made that up.
Okay. Well,
but
that's
it's one cool. or the we'll other. Find out. Probably a movie.
So, yeah. I'm about, you know, doesn't matter. They don't care how far I am. Okay. So I'm doing that. I feel like I feel like our listeners are going to shred me for this next thing I'm going to admit. Do you know what it is?
Oh, I think I do.
So I've been trying to rest my eyes.
Because of her swollen optic nerves that are not swollen apparently anymore.
Yeah.
Do you guys know that that eye doctor had her convinced that she had a damn brain tumor?
Mm-hmm.
And that was really scary.
It was very scary.
Damn him.
I thought I had a tumor in there.
There's no tumor.
There's no tumor. The one neurologist said my brain, it looks beautiful.
You got a beautiful big old brain in there. God.
I even said, I go, it's probably little, but it's beautiful.
You guys, I told my mom that Tori's MRI came back normal. And my mom's like, oh, did they find a brain in there? I'm like, Mom, come on. No, they
it
didn't.
Was a close call.
Anyway.
I've been trying to rest my eyes. And I didn't take off last week, but I limited the projects that I took on. So at nighttime, I was watching TV instead. I figured the TV's a little further away. You know, maybe I'm resting my eyes this way. So I started watching. Are you ready? I started watching. I can't even say it. I'm so embarrassed. I started watching Emily in Paris.
And how does that make you feel?
It's just so unlike me. I don't watch. Yeah. I don't. It's not. I'm not a rom-com. I'm not a comedy. I'm a comedy. I'm not like a rom-com comedy, like fluffy, happy watcher, reader of anything.
Type of girl.
Mm-mm. I like the gore. I like the grit. But I started watching it because I needed to just calm the fuck down.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very mindless. So I'm making my way through through season one of Emily in Paris.
There you go.
And I am ashamed of it. I also started watching How I Met Your Father with Hilary Duff. Another thing that is not like me.
No. Mm-mm.
But once again, I needed some mindless entertainment and I needed to rest my fucking eyes. So started watching that. I'm all caught up with that. I have it recording. So there's that.
You know what? My show like that is 911.
Yeah,
I mean, it's also like very suspenseful, but it's dumb. Like, it's not but real, like, at all.
Like, I still feel like every single thing in those episodes I would magically think that I have.
You would.
So
you would think that was going to happen to you.
Yep.
I don't know. There's also a lot of, like, the relationship drama and shit like that. Plus, the boys are just beautiful.
Yeah, I gotta look at those boys.
You know?
So that was reading, watching. I'm not listening to shit. So
no,
there's that. No listening. I got to get back into my podcast listening, but I've been listening to my audiobook. Mm-hmm. So I think that's all. That's all she wrote.
So we're going to get on our boat.
And we're going to get the fuck out of here. All but right. Just so you know.
It's time to go.
If it wasn't clear when we said it before, we love you. Bye.
Love you. Bye.